Hey everyone, we are back at the TCP. Thank you again for joining us. I really don't have a whole bunch to talk about tonight. So other than just the update on a new project, which I'm not telling you about, top 10,000 words in the first draft. It's moving along really good. It's flowing pretty well. But again, no details. I'm still working some things out before I show what it is. And tie number two, Overmatch, the sequel to Blood Red Ivory, is in process. So I got no updates on that one either. It's just kind of sitting around waiting. So with that being said, it's a quick one. And tonight I'm going to get right into talking to my guest, bestselling author Mark Cameron. Mark's a retired chief deputy U.S. Marshal. Mr. Cameron spent nearly 30 years in law enforcement. And his assignments taking him from Alaska to Manhattan, Canada, Mexico, and dozen other points in between. He holds a second degree black belt in jiu-jitsu, certified scuba diver, and man tracker, which I always wish I got to go to that training. He's an avid adventure motorcyclist. Mr. Cameron's books heavily feature bikes and bikers, from OSI agent Jericho Quinn, his beloved BMW GS, to Harley Davidson's Royal Enfields, Ducatis, and most everything on two wheels. Mr. Cameron lives in Alaska with his wife, Blue Healer, and his BMW GS. His website right here, markcameronbooks.com, and his IG is the same, Mark Cameron Books. So, Mark, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I know we tried to do this back, I think it was in May, and both of us had wires crossed, but we stuck with it and finally get to have a conversation, which is pretty cool.
That's good.
Yeah. A lot to talk about, but I want to start with Breakneck. That's a fun read. And it was funny. What I took away right from the beginning was, the way you set up the scene, especially just the opening scene, I've never been to Alaska, but it seemed like you're building the setting, just was a character almost in and of itself, of Alaska being its own, you know, challenge to overcome, but also just a gorgeous place to tell a story. I guess I just wonder if that was intentional or.
You know, I don't know intentional, but certainly natural. The Alaska is a character. There's no doubt about it. And I've wanted to live here from the time I was a little boy. I read a book called Two Against the North by a Canadian author named Farley Mowat. Sometimes it's under the title Lost in the Barrens, but it's about the Canadian North Country. But being a dyed-in-the-wool Texan/American, I wanted to stay in the United States and ended up marrying a Canadian girl, but brought her north as quick as I could. Alaska's just, it's one of those places where I came up here with the U.S. Marshals, and one of my first assignments was to go, you know, marshals have a variety of duties, and one of them is civil seizures or government seizures. And one of my first assignments was to go seize about 30,000 pounds of fish out in Western Alaska in a place called Chicnik Bay, which is down on the Aleutians. It's not in the Aleutians, it's on the mainland, but in that arm that leads to the Aleutians, where, you know, Deadliest Catch and all that. But flying out there in our 185, you know, a little float plane, the Marshal Service pilot flew me out there to do that. And I remember flying over, and I'd been in Alaska maybe 3 months, and just looking down at the herds of caribou. At that time, the salmon were running, so the rivers were just choked with red salmon, with bears sitting in the middle of them. I remember probably a 9-foot brown bear, which we call grizzlies brown bears in Alaska, and it just was surrounded by salmon, and it kind of looked up and shook its fist at it, its claws at us. And I just thought, I have stepped in the middle of a National Geographic magazine. And definitely it's been a character that's drawn me north, and I hope that comes across in the book. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, it's been a place I've always wanted to go to. And it's funny, when I was about 3 years on with the Bureau, they had a deal where I was assigned a Buffalo field office out of Quantico. So that's where I grew up. So I was used to the cold and always wanted to go to Alaska. And they came out with a deal. If you went to Anchorage field office and gave them 5 years, you got office of preference throughout the rest. Yeah. And I come home, I'm like, this is a done deal. So I come home one day and I go to my wife, who is a, and she's going to be mad that I'm telling this story, but she is a sun-loving South Carolina girl from Charleston. So I come home like, hey, this is going to be sweet. We're going to go to Anchorage 5 years, and then we'll come back and I'll try to get Charlotte or Charleston. You know, we'll just pop right back there. Won't have to move again. She's like, absolutely not. I was like, you don't even want to think about it. And she's like, nope, it's dark there or it's light there and I'll get depressed. I'm like, ah, that's not how it works.
Well, you know what, it's a lot of people feel that way. My wife, the first thing she said, and she's from Calgary, Alberta, so she's from the north, but a bigger city in the north than where we live, but you know, she grew up in Calgary, then I moved her back to Texas and about, you know, killed her with sweat and bugs and ticks and chiggers and all snakes, things that she wasn't used to. But I remember we were laying in bed one night and she was reading the Bible and I was reading the Cabela's catalog, as we're, you know, that's sort of a litmus, and that's a good illustration of our spirituality there. But so she was reading and I was reading, and my friend from Alaska called and said, hey, there's gonna be an opening up here. And at that time we were stationed in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which is beautiful, absolutely beautiful area, and a target rich environment at that time for a Fed, because there was just a lot of white supremacists and kind of anti-federal stuff. It was a great place to live and beautiful, and but a little bit of a tough time to raise children there. So I'd always wanted to go to Alaska, as I said earlier, and my friend called me, and I'd been up twice, I think. The first time I'd gone up was for I was with the premier of China, and I was detailed to the State Department, and we had to keep somebody on their version of Air Force One before they left the the United States, and so we had to stay on until we got to Alaska, where they refueled, and then we got off. So I was able to see it, and I just knew, yep, this is where I want to go. So my friend, he called, said, hey, there's an opening here, you got to come up. And we talked for maybe 45 minutes, and my wife is listening and listening and listening. And I hung up excited, much like your wife. She said, we are not going to Alaska. And then I think I used flip charts, and, you know, we didn't have PowerPoint at the time, but kind of illustrated to her what it was really like. And then we came up at that time I had been published by a small press, and we came up for a book signing, and I brought her with me, and it was in the middle of winter, and she realized in Anchorage it wasn't dark 24/7 in the winter. Right. And they had malls and, you know, regular stores and all that. So about 3 months later after that, we moved up here. So
That's nice. It's funny. The you mentioned bringing your Calgary wife to Texas. The first year we're in Buffalo, my wife calls me on her birthday, June, and I'm working. I'm running a lead, and so as I'm coming over the Grand Island like connector, just snow hits my windshield. I'm like, whatever. And she calls me up, and I'm like, I didn't forget your birthday. Like, I know, I got the plan. Like, we're good. And she's like, no, that's not it. I figured. She goes, it's snowing. And I'm like, yeah, I see it. It's right on my windshield. She's like, it's snowing in June. It's June. I'm like,
that's right.
I probably should have warned you about that.
Yeah. Buffalo, you guys get more snow in Buffalo than we do here a lot. I mean, you guys are dumped on.
Oh yeah, there's that line that goes right along the thruway that just, if you're on the wrong side of it, just boom, because it comes right off Lake Erie and, you know, sinks your house.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yep.
That's awesome.
But yeah, getting back to Breakneck, there was, and you know, it's hard to have these conversations without giving stuff away, but you know, that's with Arliss and Lola, the kind of dynamics that you come up with those teams, those two play off each other really well. And I'm saying this because I have a further question a little down the road, but the just Western feel of it is that it just felt like a Western to me. Cause I mean, it's a little knit awesome. Group of people and they're kind of out there. There's not a whole lot of backup coming. And if they do get backup coming, it's not coming for a while. So walking into a known conflict, but also not having resources for when everything goes wrong. But still doing it. It felt like it had that nice Western adventure feel to me. But it also just reminded me of, you know, those points in police work where it's like, well, this call is going to suck, but we don't have a whole lot of people. We're just going, you know, does that come from your past as, just walking into what you think is going to be a relatively normal conversation and having just chaos blow up all over the place?
Yeah. That's the beauty of, you know, I started writing Westerns. I wanted to be published with short stories. I wrote short stories for 20 years and got rejection letters for 20 years and just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. And finally got published by Boys Life magazine and Saturday Evening Post. But my kind of break, if you will, through the New York publishing sector was to publish Westerns. And I literally ghost wrote. My name's not on the title, like with the Clancys, my name's on the title. So that's more of a write for hire thing. But I ghost wrote several Westerns for a name you see all over the place when you're in Walmart or wherever. And then they published mine under the name Mark Henry. And I with a K, because that was my fake ID name in the Marshall Service.
Way to drop that in there.
Yeah, exactly. But I think all my books are Westerns, really. I mean, the Jericho Quins, they ride motorcycles instead of their buddy books. And in the Cutters, you know, it's Lola Tariki and Arliss Cutter, who are the buddies. I grew up in Texas. So the one riot, one ranger mentality where, you know, that, you know, you only sent one ranger. Well, you only got one riot, right? And so the Marshall Service definitely has that kind of a mentality because we're, as you know, from being in the Bureau, you guys fortunately had more lobbyists than we had deputy marshals, you know.
That's
and
right.
and good on you, no hard feelings there. But when I started in the Marshall Service in 1991, we had a joke that, remember when Avis and Hertz were sort of running rental car ads against one another, and I can't remember who it was. I think Hertz was one and Avis was number two, and the Marshall Service in the Department of Justice, we always said we're like, you know, we're number two, so we try harder kind of thing, because the Bureau was always number one. So we're generally out there, and I was in offices. I was in East Texas, but really north of Dallas in Sherman, Texas, up by the Red River. And it was just me and my partner, and that was all. And so we really depended on our friends in the Bureau. We depended on local, state and local law enforcement. And oftentimes where we were, really, it was just us. And North Idaho, it was absolutely just us, because we'd go up in some places and some of the local agencies weren't real keen on helping feds back when I moved there. And then Alaska is just geographically, it's, you know, we work with the troopers and awesome partners with the troopers and Anchorage PD, but on a, you know, macro and micro level, when you're out in the bush, sometimes there's just no way to get help there. Because if I think maybe three books ago, Stone Cross, there's a bit of, in the Arliss Cutter series, there's a bit of business that, you know, in the old Agatha Christie novels, how they all end up stranded in a mansion somewhere and have to solve the, well, that happens all the time here. I don't know how many times I've been out, or I sent deputies out later when I was in a leadership position, where you send folks out, and if it's particularly freeze up or break up, when the only way you can get somewhere is by river, either when the river becomes a frozen highway, you know, an ice road, or when it's open and you can take a boat, during freeze up and break up, you can't take a boat and you can't take a snow machine or a vehicle. And so you have to take an aircraft. And if it's cloudy, where you have a low ceiling, you just can't get there. I mean, we've had public health aides who are, you know, they're a little bit higher than not a paramedic yet, but higher than an EMT. And they've got training and they've done surgery on the table at the high school cafeteria. Well, the school, it's everything school, but the school cafeteria on the phone with the doctor, because there's just no other way. There was absolutely zero chance of anyone getting in. And my editor one time, he said, "How come you always have a big storm coming?" And I said, "Cause that's Alaska. That's like Thursday in Alaska." Yeah. So, I appreciate that you see these as Westerns, because, you know, I started at a small department in Texas. I was a mounted police officer. I was a horseshoer before I started, did horseshoeing, because I think I made $6.50 an hour as a police officer in the 80s. So I think I kind of have that vernacular just naturally. And I think it naturally comes, for good or bad, comes across in the books.
Yep. And I don't understand how that genre is not bigger than it is. I mean, everybody loves a Western. You know, you put a decent Western out, like Yellowstone. Like when Yellowstone first came out, I was like, I don't see that one making it. Like, and then holy crap, it was like everybody's addicted to it, right? So but yeah, the Western books, that genre just isn't and I don't know if it's a demographic thing, an age thing, but there's always adventure and that independence in that genre. And I've never understood why it's not bigger, because I grew up with Matt Braun. It wasn't I don't know why it wasn't always so much Louis L'Amour, but Matt Braun's, Black Fox was the first one I read. Mm-hmm. And then of course Tombstone and Dodge City and all those great just great stories. And I don't know why it's not bigger. I love
it. Well, they're just good stories, but I think in the same way that when I was growing up, I loved Westerns, but I also loved the stories about, knights and nobody reads that kind of thing anymore, or the Three Musketeers. It's very rare that you'll see swashbuckling, because it's a slightly more distant in history. And plus in the West, the Westerns that you see now are generally about anti-heroes, where the Westerns we saw growing up, or I saw growing up, you're younger than I am, but they were heroes. They were heroic. Now, there were a few anti-heroes, and those usually won Academy Awards because people like to watch that. But I think we require, and readers require, a little more, just a little more nuance. I mean, I had a buddy come up. If anybody looks on my social media, they'll see that I had a good friend that was in the Marshal Service Academy with me, came up, named Billy Johnson. And he's very much that quintessential cowboy. He and I were both from Texas when we went through the Marshals Academy in Georgia there over 30 years ago. I talked to him on the phone dozens and dozens of times. He reads my book. I steal his cool sayings for my books. He's very much a West Texas deputy marshal. I haven't seen him in forever, but we were sitting around talking, and my wife kind of noticed that a third of our conversation was just one-liners from Lonesome Dove. And my kids were all trying to figure out, my daughter and son-in-law were here, and they were trying to figure out what we were talking about. And I realized my son-in-law and my daughter hadn't watched Lonesome Dove since they've been adults. So I was so gratified to come home from, I don't remember where I was, going to town for something. And I came in and they had Lonesome Dove pulled up on their laptop watching it. And of course, that was my day. I just sat and watched over their shoulders and was so happy. So Lonesome Dove came out in, I think, 1989. I was a mounted police officer, and this was back before streaming, when you had to be home to watch it when it came on. So we, like, as the mounted patrol, we moved our schedule around so we could all be home to watch Lonesome Dove. And I remember, because we had a really tiny TV with a channel changer. You had to use pliers to change the channels. But it was still, it was the best show I've ever seen in my life. But that's a nuanced Western, and it won the Pulitzer. So good stories are nuanced and layered, they're going to be good, whether it's a Robert Parker Western Appaloosa or Laramie Mercury or whatever.
Yeah, and it's and as you're saying that, it's you know, I grew up with my dad, John Wayne, you know, all day long. So I grew up with Rio Bravo. I will stop what I'm doing and sit down and watch Rio Bravo anytime that movie comes on. But yeah. He's got those, you know, he just walks on stage like, oh, there's a hero. He's about to kick somebody's ass. Right.
Right. But
it's funny. It's funny that you say the audience demands that nuance now of having that grayscale instead of the shining white hero and the deep, dark villain. When he did Searchers. And he had that dark side to him. He had that dark
big
side to
dark
him.
Side.
It did not translate to me as a little kid at all. I was like, that's not.
Oh, yeah.
I was like,
that's John not Wayne him. Can't be mean.
That's yeah. Right. How is he being mean to that kid?
He's
I'm not
going
to
murder. He's going to murder Natalie Wood. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it didn't translate. But today, I think if you gave somebody like for me, my kids love like the Pirates of the Caribbean. So if you made Jack Sparrow a shining white hero, they would that would have never made it. It wouldn't have even made it to the screen.
You know, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, but yeah, the you know, talking about Arliss and Lola made me think about dynamics of your other books. You've got the Jericho Quinn series, the Cutter series, the Jack Ryan series, and then your first one with Mark Henry. As I'm looking at them and as I'm flipping through, you know, what I can, as I'm getting ready to talk to you, when, so you've got these very distinctive characters in these very distinctive situations. Is it one of those things where you come up with like a story idea, like your idea of, like Zero Day, like, you know, your story, do you come up with like the Zero Day plot first and say Jericho Quinn is the guy for this? Or do you say, I've got this character, I've sketched him out, his name's Jericho Quinn or Arliss Cutter, and then I'm going to build stories around him in an arc?
That's a good question. No, when I'm writing a whatever character, if I'm going to write and because I write a series or several series, I'm thinking usually about a year ahead. Okay, I need to send a synopsis because they're going to start working on the cover and stuff like that. And so my editor and I will go back and forth about what kind of story, and we'll come up with a synopsis for that character. But the characters are definitely first. And the way I feel like I know these characters pretty well. And so I know the characters, especially, you know, after writing a few, like with Jericho, it's eight novels and two novellas. So come up with a story. I mean, have the characters, then come up with a story, and then plunk my characters down in the middle of that story, and then let them react the way I know that they're going to react. And generally speaking, when I get, you know, kind of paint myself into a corner, it's because I've got Jericho not reacting like Jericho would, or Jacques Thibodeau, his partner, not reacting like I know that he would, or Arliss being maybe too nice, or, you know, whatever or Lola being too dark when she's vivacious and bubbly. And I need some, so I'll basically, when I've made an error and tried to shoehorn them in because of the way I think, because I'm a very meticulous plotter, I'll use up for a Jack Ryan novel, for instance, I'll do maybe 8 or 10 notepads of just free writing. And for a Cutter, 4 or 5, and Jericho the same, 4 or 5. Just I write a lot with pencils or fountain pen, and I'll just write, and then I boil that down to scenes, and then flesh out those scenes for the book. And sometimes I'm wrong. Sometimes I get going and think, no, this just wouldn't happen. This just doesn't ring true. So I just try, you know, it's always with me, it's always character first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just thought that'd be
a good question.
Yeah. I just, as I'm looking at them, I'm like, man, they all have their own arcs and their own things. And it's been both, like, for Ty Benhoff, he's an amalgam of all the most fun people I've worked with over the years, right? The biggest wise asses, the funniest one-liners that I've ever heard, you know, sitting on a surveillance cracking up, because you just, you know, the dude sitting next to you is just making it hard to be a professional, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And then so for the first book, it's definitely, you know, Ty's here and he needs something to do. For the second book, it was kind of a, not to say it was a tie, but that's a horrible way to say it. But I had an idea of an incident that I wanted to throw him in the middle of. So that one's a tie. Yeah, again, that's my bad. But for the next one is going into the third, it's like, okay, the arc now. Like, what am I, is he just going to face a new bad guy every time, or is he actually going to, is there going to be a growth arc, you know? So it's been a different kind of dynamic. But
well, I think there always has to be an arc with well, I shouldn't say always, like with the Jack Ryan is Jack Ryan, and he was developed by Tom Clancy, and so I think it's incumbent on us as writers that carry on those characters of John Clark or Jack Ryan. And I was able to give, since I'm an old, you know, grandpa, former action guy, keeping my toe in the water a little bit with, you know, with a son that's in law enforcement and another one that was, I can give him a bit of an arc because he's aged since Without Remorse and mm-hmm. Some of All Fears. So give him some arc as a, maybe a little more, you know, gets misty eyed when he thinks about his grandkids, but he can still kick ass, that kind of guy. But I'm not going to change Jack Ryan and have him go through a big growing experience. There'll be small things that happen. But with my characters, hopefully, if I'm doing it right, Arliss and his relationship with his, you know, widowed sister-in-law, and Jericho and his relationship with his ex-wife, who he still loves, but he's got this new love interest in Garcia, you know, the thing is, the arc when you write a series has to be slow or you end your series, and which is not necessarily bad. Who knows how long these will go, but at some point they need to face their demons, or else, my gosh, it goes on forever and ever, and they're just becomes a, you know, they become a killing instrument for the government, and I don't want that. So there has to be some kind of and who knows what new spinoffs we've talked about. There's a character in the Arliss Cutter books that really never appears except in flashbacks, and that's Arliss's grandfather, Grumpy. And I've got a whole book plotted out with Grumpy pre-Arliss, back when he was in law enforcement in the early 80s, when I was in law enforcement. So it'd be fun and I can explore his arc and see what makes him tick. So there's a lot to mine in those sort of things, but the arcs are what make things fun.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. It's what makes our characters endearing, even when they're, exactly, you know, beating people to death.
And identifiable with other people. Like, I think all the time when I write you know, this as well as I do, a writer has this wonderful gift of being able to edit and rewrite, where when we get into a debate with someone on an elevator and leave, as soon as the door shut behind us, we think, dang it, I know exactly what I should have said. Your character, we can figure out and we can make it so snarky and quick and right on, because we have the benefit of waking up in the middle of the night and writing it down in our little notepad, you know, at night, and making
super unlimited smart tries.
Exactly.
Unlimited I can take, tries. take 10,000.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's funny. You saying that makes me think that, you know, at like certain dinner parties or out and about, the wife will just give me a look, like she'll just see me about to make things awkward. And she'll just be like, just stop. What she can do it with a flash of an eye. She's like, you're about to make things weird. Cut it out.
Oh, yeah. My wife will say sometimes at some church function or something, I'll feel the wrath of her boot on the side of my ankle. And she's like, we are with some civilized people. Do not tell that story.
That's right.
I'm sure every cop's felt that before.
Yeah. And she still remembers the 10 codes, but better than I do. And it's been 20 years since I've had to use a 10 code, but, if me and the guys are back together and that starts coming out, she'll be like, oh yeah, that's a 48. That's a 42. That's a 55. I'm like, I couldn't do that right now. She's like, trust me, I've heard you idiots for so long. Like,
now that's cool you say that, because I think spouses of law enforcement are often, and I try to explore this a bit in the books. I mean, law enforcement and a life kind of addicted to danger is what broke up Jericho Quinn's marriage. And, you know, and, but what's interesting is that even then I'm able to, even though she, him is his ex-wife's name, and she was just so tired of him being in, you know, and this was back when I wrote this, my eldest son was in OSI, and you were NCIS, right?
Yeah, I did some time with NCIS.
Yeah, so he was OSI. A lot of people, whenever I explain OSI, I always go, well, like NCIS, except for the Air Force. In fact, it was kind of funny that the production company that did NCIS went to OSI first, and OSI said, nah, that'll not be a very interesting show. And so then they went to NCIS, and yeah, well, there and there you go.
The rest is history.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember when my youngest son was Anchorage Police. He's moved on to the feds now, but he was Anchorage Police up until this last summer. And I remember 8 years ago when he was getting ready to go, he was done with the academy, done with field training. And you know how gut-wrenching FTO can be. I mean, that's the most horrible part of police work. And so he was done with the FTO, and he was going out on his own for the first time. And midnight, he was on midnight shift. And Anchorage can be a rough city after midnight. It's the largest city in Alaska. It's just like I used to tell my kids when they're growing up, boy, you just don't want to be out in Anchorage after midnight. And that's when, you know, it's got a fairly high, for a city its size, it's got a pretty high crimes against person rate after midnight. And if you're in the wrong places, which is where coppers go, right?
That's the best place to hunt.
It's a great place to raise kids. It's a great city, very welcoming, great tourist city, but there's just places you don't go after midnight, and downtown Anchorage is one of them. And I remember just being beside myself, because I thought, if something happens to my son, I'm going to be the one that takes the blame, because I'm the guy he followed into this line of work. He called me from college and said, what do you think about me doing this? And I, you know, yay, you're taking up the family business, that kind of thing. And so I was, you know, making deals with God, please keep him safe, I'll be good, you know, all kinds of stuff, just beside myself. And I looked over, and my wife was fine. She was just calm as can be. And I couldn't understand it. Our baby boy was, our youngest is out in the mean streets at night by himself. And I said, Vicky, what's the matter with you? And she said, very calmly and very sweetly, Mark, this is new to you. I've been feeling this for 30 years. Oh. And I thought, man, I need to put that in a book, because that's really, it really typifies what I think police spouses, whether it's a wife or a husband, go through when they watch their spouse, you know, lace up their boots and strap on their gun and put their backup gun. There's something really visceral about watching somebody put a backup gun in a little bug pocket on their vest, because then you're not only they're wearing a ballistic vest, but they think life might be so bad that they're going to need gun number two. And it's a life. There's certainly my hat is off to law enforcement spouses.
Yep. Yeah. And that you never think about it, because it's like, hey, I want to go do this. She's like, okay. And I'm like, okay. She's letting me do that. All right, I'm in. I'll take this TDY. Well, I'll take that TDY.
Absolutely. And you're telling you probably, I remember going on a Dixie Mafia trial in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, early in my career. We'd had a government witness killed, not a protected witness, but a, you know, somebody testifying for the government. And man, I thought this is going to be a great adventure. And I'd been on the Marshal Service 6 months and not even that. So I get sent on this 3 week or 4 week TDY. It's the Dixie Mafia. Same guy that killed Buford Pusser, anybody that studied, you know, Walking Tall, same guy that killed his wife was one of the guys on trial. Prostitutes, gambling, just the dregs of the criminal society. We're flying people in. And I'm telling my wife this, we had a guy shot in the eye. And you know, I'm so excited. You know what? We're getting up early in the morning. We're moving our prisoners via Black Hawk, and, you know, and we're keeping them in, and I'm going to go spend the week in jail in Purvis, Mississippi, because we can't trust the key. We need to have somebody there that's a fed, because they lock the jail at night and give the key to the senior trustee, you know, I'm telling, and so I'm going to be in jail, telling her all these stories, thinking she's sharing in my adventure. And at the same time, I was driving an old, since I was the junior guy out of the pair of us, I drove the cage car. And so my partner had a nice new Crown Vic, and I had an old Caprice. This was when Caprices still looked cool before they were the Shamu Caprices.
Before the Shamu, yeah.
It was a nice, same kind of car I drove on patrol, a nice long hood Caprice, fast car, but it had a cage in it. And so they needed the cage car, and he had hired another local policeman to be a guard. And so they drove over in his car, and they were going to pick up the cage car. Well, this was Texas. Everybody wore hats. I wore a hat. And he showed up at my front door, and being the nice cowboy that he was, he went and rang the doorbell to tell my wife, hey, we're taking the car. And so two men in suits showed up with hats.
Oh, man.
Hearts. And my wife answered the door and fell on her butt.
Ugh.
Just passed out when she saw him. You just don't think. You just do not think. So, again, man, my hat's off to law enforcement spouses, especially mine.
Yeah, and I will say, I didn't know this at the time, but, you know, I was up visiting a buddy of mine who retired from the alumni, you know, Charleston PD. And as we're sitting around, we're in his office just, you know, shooting the bull. And I check out the, you know, the frame, the patches, the badges, the whole, this is your career, you know, frame that they're going to give him, the shadow box. Mm-hmm. And then up next to it is one that the command staff did for his wife to commemorate, you know, they gave her also a retirement.
That's awesome.
Shadow box for spending 25 years as a police wife. And I had, you know, you think about it, like all the time she's just been like, yes, go, you know, that sounds ridiculous, but go ahead and have fun. But at the same time, she's just like, she never watches the news. She doesn't look at anything. And, you know, so, but yeah, for a PD to take the time to say, you know, you have served and sacrificed almost worse than he has, because he's having fun for 25 years and you're sitting home. I thought that was one of the coolest things I've seen in a long time. Yeah.
That is absolutely outstanding.
Yeah. Yeah, so hands off Charleston PD. You guys do it right.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I feel like if we had a little bit of bourbon in between us, we could probably tell war stories till like midnight.
sorry.
Oh no, I love it. I love it. And I think it'd be a great way to spend the evening.
There you go.
I did want to ask, while I had you, like, what is it like when you're the first time you start writing and you're writing what Jack Ryan is doing? You're taking such an iconic character and just, this is, you are the guy telling the world what Jack Ryan's up to. I find
pretty
that
terrifying. Pretty terrifying. Yeah. I very nearly had a stroke when they called me to ask me about it, because it's not something you ask to do. You just get called out of the blue. And fortunately, I was friends with Mark Graney, and he recommended me to Tom Colgan, who's the editor. And I told Tom Colgan, I don't know, maybe a month after I started it, that had the person not been terrified that he asked to do it, that he probably would have picked the wrong person, because there's a lot of scrutiny to it. And, you know, people read where, you know, I'll sell tens of thousands of books over the course of the life of a book, but Clancy will sell that many before it even comes out or more. So, but being able, you know, because I grew up, I mean, Hunt for Red October came out while I was in the police academy in 1984. And so I can gauge where my career was by what Tom Clancy book was coming out. You know, I know I went to New York on a judicial protection assignment when Some of All Fears came out. I went to New York on a UNGA, a UN General Assembly assignment on the Japanese detail when actually that's the one when the Sum of All Fears came out, because, and I remember that distinctly because I left my book, that's when it came out in paperback, and I left my book on the airplane. And then when I know it was the Japanese foreign minister detail, because I was reading it in the down room, like the CP, and I left it there. And then one of the State Department special agents impounded it and took it to his room to read because it was, he thought it was just a left behind. So I ended up having to buy Some of All Fears paperback three times just to get to the end of it. But so writing Jack Ryan and particularly John Clark, I've always, I think a lot of us have identified with John Clark, but writing those two characters and Mary Pat Foley and Dean Chavez, those four in particular, less so with the campus characters, but I enjoyed them. But those four were the ones that I grew up with, you know, as I said, grew up, but, you know, as a young man. And I remember going to FLETC and Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And when I went, it was the old buildings that aren't even there anymore with exposed radiators. And I remember thinking, this must be what, you know, the farm is like. This must be what KGB training is like. This, these ratty old buildings with exposed radiators and, you know, Eastern Seaboard sand fleas and, oh, you know, and
the townhouses.
You know, yeah, the townhouses. Yeah, exactly. Townhouse. So, yeah. Well, I didn't even get to live in a townhouse. I live in building 60, which not even there anymore.
It's not there anymore. Like
a, yep. No. And so the classes after me got townhouses. So we were in the double, basically two rooms in a little Motel 6 looking place with a shared bathroom with the two beds next in the room next door. So, but again, I thought it was going to be real militaristic. And when I went through, and it got that way a little bit more, but when I went through, maids came in and picked up, you know, cleaned up after you and all that, which was a surprise to me. So it was a great place to go to school. And I felt like, I think I wrote a letter home to my wife that said, this is like playing Clue and getting paid for it, you know?
That's right.
But yeah, it's pretty daunting. And knowing that what you, I guess the responsibility of keeping the characters the same. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed writing all the books, and I just turned in my last one. I'm only going to do 7. That's a lot, and it's a lot for your brain space. Mark Graney did 7, and I feel like since he was the first, he ought to, I shouldn't break his record. I can tie it, but I'm not going to break it.
Yeah.
But out of all, and I enjoyed writing the one that's going to come out in November, but by far my favorite one was Red Winter, because it took the one from last year, because it took the characters back to the 80s when they were the, you know, John Clark, Mary Pat Foley, and of course Jack Ryan, back when they were young and in the business, on in the field, and a lot of responsibility, but a heck of a lot of fun. Heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. I grew up with Jack Ryan too, but I went out of order. Like I saw Hunt for Red October when I was a kid, and I was like, well, I don't need to read that book. So I started with like Patriot Games, and I was just like, oh man, this guy's a doctor. He's a historian, mm-hmm. and he is laying waste in places. Like that's mm-hmm. like, is this what it means to be a CIA agent or an mm-hmm. analyst? Not even that, an analyst. Mm-hmm. So of course, and then, you know, as you progress, once they introduced Ding and Clark, I think I gravitated towards Ding just because of, you know, the age. I think mm-hmm. it was more in parody. And but man, just as I'm looking at, watching that proceed, it's like, man, I was talking to Jerome Preissler a little while ago, but what always staggers me is Clancy was a guy who had an idea, wrote it down, just Jack Ryan, poof, just came out of his head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, within 20 years, he's trying to buy the Minnesota Vikings, right? Mm-hmm. It's just to see that kind of creativity and just see what can be built out of somebody's random stray thought that they probably had in the shower is yeah. amazing.
Yeah. And it was a time too. I mean, that was not a, now techno thriller writers are, I don't want to say a dime a dozen, but there's a lot of us. And he was the first, and he really, you know, there were military writers, but not so much. And plus it was a time, I believe, because I've read every Clancy book now 3 times at least, and some of them more, and got them, you know, tabbed and, you know, but as the zeitgeist, the people were ready, because we didn't have Wikipedia. We didn't have the internet at all. We, you know, in the early Clancy books, he's reading, you know, Jane's weapons of the world and all that Ryan is. And, you know, you see it in the movies, but in the books it's, and the movies are great, but I couldn't watch the movies while I was writing these because the movie, the details of them, like Ding Chavez, for instance, isn't a sniper in the books. Yeah. He's an infantryman and got some special skills, but he's a soldier. And he's kind of handpicked for Clear and Present Danger by Clark. And of course, to Clark's chagrin, he becomes his son-in-law. and happy chagrin. Yeah. But so I try to keep the details. And that was on advice from Mark Graney, you know, really focus on the books. Don't, because they're completely different worlds. But yeah, they're fun to write. But I think the people nowadays require, and what I've told the other writers, that like the Jack Ryan Jr. writers, Don Bentley and Mike Madden, that I've chatted with a lot because we wrote, you know, opposite each other, you know, on the calendar. And they were writing the juniors while I was writing the seniors. And I feel like it's incumbent on us, and this is just my opinion, but it's incumbent on us as Clancy writers today. If Clancy were alive, he would have written a different book than Without Remorse, or maybe not Hunt for Red October, but Without Remorse, the visceral feeling that we get when we read Without Remorse, it would have to be written a little bit different today, because if you just line out the former Navy SEAL picks up a 16 or 17 year old girl on the side of the road, gets her pregnant, that wouldn't fly today. But yeah, that was not, we were reading it in a different, you know, a different background. So what we have to do is write these so that we make the reader feel like Tom Clancy made us feel. And to do that, we have to write a little different book, as I believe, because Clancy was brilliant. And I believe he would have done that. He wrote for his time. And if he were alive today, he would be writing for this time. His books would have morphed.
Yeah, when I read his over, and my go-tos when I read over his books is always Without Remorse and Clear and Present Danger. Mm-hmm. But the intricacies that he goes into as I'm reading sometimes, you know, when he does go into like Jane's, and when he does go into mm-hmm. that 19th level detail of, you know, how the Red October works, or how the Fast Attack Sub works. Mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder if people would be able to keep with that. Like, I just wonder if they would dedicate enough to learn this specific system of this submarine does this, and this is how it does it. Mm-hmm. It hurts to think about that, because I remember as a kid reading this and being like, this is amazing. But then, you know, I've had discussions today that's like, I don't know if my brain works the same way as it did when I was a kid, when all I had to do was sit around and read a book for hours at a time, you know?
No, you're right. I think we'll just take a look at the news now. When you look online, most every news article says 3-minute read, 2-minute read, 90-second read. We have to be told how long it's going to take us to read this, or else it's TLDR, too long, didn't read. I can't imagine writing an acronym like TLDR back when I was young. We wrote 5-paragraph essays as a matter of course I don't know if you're still employed with federal law enforcement, but I was a chief, and it was mind-boggling to me. And I had some great folks working for me and with me, but writing a coherent document that's 5 paragraphs long is a skill that's just, it's not necessarily being taught nowadays. And the people learned it, but they learned it generally from me working with them and me getting U.S. attorneys to come in and say, here's what we need, you know? So yeah, it's a different world. It's a definitely a different world. And we have to write a different kind of, my editor with Kensington always says, you know, start with a massacre and build from there.
Yeah, got to get the hook, right? Got to start with the hook. Yep. Yeah. And you said something a little bit back to backtrack a little bit, but you said you read all those books like 3 times, you've got them tabbed out. So you've got this canon you have to stick to, but at the same time, you've got, you know, Greeny, Bentley, all the other guys that are swimming in the same pond. Mm-hmm. how, like, there's got to be coordination. Like, would you, if when you came up, come up with an idea or have a scene, will you like maybe call the war room together and be like, all right, guys, I want to walk through this. Am I going to screw any of your next books up?
Yeah. So yes and no. Mike and I talked a little bit, Mike Madden, Don and I talked a bit more. I referred back to Mark a lot because, you know, because I was taking over from him. And so I would ask him, you know, because I knew he really liked soccer. And so he had made Jack Jr. like soccer. And I wanted to make sure I didn't make him have the wrong favorite team, you know, little things. Because people that read Clancy's read them with a TI-80 graphing calculator and a slide rule. And, you know, they're down to the nitty gritty and call you out on the nth degree. And sometimes, I mean, I think Jerry Hindley, who's the guy that owns Hindley and Associates, which is the white side of the campus. I think one of the authors has him being a former senator from one state and another one from another state. And one, he likes one kind of whiskey, another likes another. So there are things that you just choose which way to go. But with Mike and Don, they generally kept to Jack Ryan Jr. and I got everybody else. Now they will put members of the campus in there, but that's the way we deconflicted. And like Don was kind of joking, you know, kind of calling me out because I injured one of the main characters who I created. I don't kill off or brutally injure anybody that Clancy created. That's not my business. That's I figure he created him. I'm not going to be the one to kill him off, but I will harm and I don't create a character just to kill. I know writers that do that, but I want it to be integral to the plot and happen organically. But I don't want it to be, I think that's kind of emotional blackmail to do something like that. Here, love this person, now kill him. Yeah. Sometimes they have to die because that's the, I mean, I had a lady who's probably in her late 70s waylay me at a VoucherCon one time and with tears in her eyes, just upset that I'd killed a character in a Jericho Quinn book. And I, when she understood that I cried too, when that happened, then, and that particular character appeared in three books before she finally died. And you can't write books where characters are in constant danger and not have some good guy make the ultimate sacrifice, good guy or good gal, and make them ring true. And so with the Clancys, they knew that I was going to keep the main characters alive. They knew. And then actually it kind of morphed to where I didn't even write Jack Jr. anymore. I think three books ago, because I was given direction that, you know, he's in all the books and Jack Sr.'s in all the books. And so in the first two, Jack Jr. Jack Jr. had quite a big role. And then after that, talking to Mike and Don, I realized that no matter how hard we tried, we were going to write a different Jack Jr. because we're different writers. Mm-hmm. Yep. And with them barely mentioning Jack Sr., it really wasn't an issue, or Ding or Clark. But so I remember Tom Colgan, in one of his early editorial comments on book three, I think, he said, you literally have Jack Jr. sitting in the back of the van, not saying much of anything. And said, yeah, he's part of the campus and that's theirs to deal with. But we definitely had a lot of discussions about just overall plot and thrust of the, we usually got each other's manuscripts while we were working on ours. So,
oh yeah.
And I think the reference. New guys, Anders and Wilson, that are taking over, I'm excited to see theirs. Of course, mine still hasn't even come out yet. And I think they're done with theirs already. But with their military background and Navy background, I think they're going to take it back to a lot more of a military series where because I don't have a military background, I had more espionage and Secret Service and FBI and more like, you know, more and SWAT and that sort of thing. So more like kind of a Rainbow Six and Some of All Fears. And my favorite Clancy is the Cardinal of the Kremlin because I like that intelligence background kind of thing.
Oh yeah, they had the spy novels, but yeah, he did just take it to that next level. It was
absolutely.
Yeah, and but it's awesome. It's got to be an amazing feeling to be writing a character of that level. So, it's very cool, and I enjoy it. So, for the millions of readers out there, thank you very much for carrying on the way you did.
It's great fun, but what we all have to think of is, and Mark Graney and I discussed this, Don and I have discussed this, everybody that, and Boyd Morrison, who wrote for Cussler, at some point you have to bet on yourself. And not that we want to be the next Tom Clancy or whatever, we just want to be the next, John Stamp or we want to be the first John Stamp or the first Mark Cameron, not the next Tom Clancy. And while it's been a great honor, and I would do it all over again, especially working with Tom Colgan, great editor, just fantastic editor. It's been fun working with him. But at some point we need to think of new stuff, as writers.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. I agree. And, I've had you going almost an hour, and I know everybody's got stuff to do, but I ask the same question when I've got veterans on and when I've got first responders on, law enforcement on. So before we clear up, and thank you for joining me tonight, but just in case there's that kid wrapping up college, trying to figure out what he wants to do, and he sees that black and white rolling up and down the street, and he thinks that looks fun. The advice that you'd give somebody that asks you, should I be a cop? What's your advice? Is anybody looking to go into law enforcement?
Well, this is a topic of great debate lately, but I believe that law enforcement is a calling more than a job. And I still, if I had somebody make a comment to me several years ago when I was at a conference, man, New York Times bestselling author, you want to do this forever, you've got your dream job. And I said, I do, but I've been fortunate enough to have both my dream jobs. And when I think right now I've got the second best job in the world, because to me, being a deputy U.S. Marshal, it's what I wanted to do the whole time I was in local law enforcement. I wanted to be a deputy U.S. Marshal. And that was the best job in the world. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't miss the people and I don't miss the job. I don't miss the politics at all, but I miss the mission and I miss the people. Now, most of my war stories come from my 7 years on patrol and, with the local law enforcement, because of what local law enforcement does. And my son, as I said, just got out of local law enforcement to go federal. My oldest was a OSI agent. They were in kind of the blue bloods kind of a thing. In fact, at one point, we've got a picture of us, and I had just retired, so I had a retired badge. My youngest son was in the academy with his recruit badge, and my oldest was OSI, so we've got all three badges lined up there. So I would definitely say, if you're the kind of person who, and I always, because I have a lot of people, I'm sure, will ask me this exact question. They'll come over with their spouse, and they'll chat and we'll have dinner and they'll talk to them. I always encourage them to talk to my wife as well. And I'll say, think of this. If you're in a mall with your family and you hear gunfire, distant gunfire, what's your first inclination? Is your first inclination to get your family to safety? Because that's what it should be, right? But then is your next inclination to go and see what you can do? Or is it to hunker down and take cover, get out to safety, whatever? Neither one of those are wrong. The right answer is probably get your family out. Well, I know it is. Get your family out and then be a good witness, all that kind of thing. But go to safety. But and I'm not saying this is what you should do, but if your inclination is to run towards gunfire, then that's probably the right job for you, because it really is a calling. And no matter what people say about, it's not like it used to be, because it's not. It's never, nothing's ever like it used to be. My FTOs, I'm sure your FTOs, all my FTOs were Vietnam vets in the early 80s, and they griped about my generation, and we're griping about the new generation. But law enforcement is a noble calling, and I would do it again in a minute.
Yep. Yeah. It's I would have to agree with all that. I left it, to see what that federal side had to offer, but I still think the best part was those first couple of years running patrol. You never know what's going to happen. You can't beat that. So
agreed.
I appreciate you joining me, and I appreciate this. It's been a great conversation. And I did mention earlier, but markcameronbooks.com or on Instagram, markcameronbooks. But Mark, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun, John.
All right. Anytime you want to come back, just let me know.
Awesome.
All right. Good night, everybody.